Welcome to Tom SciCast, and I'm your host, Tom Kennedy. Now today, I want to start this podcast off with a question. You know, life has been on this planet for over 4 billion years, and throughout that time, it's had some pretty amazing innovations. I mean, today we have millions of species of plants and animals living on the Earth. But have you ever stopped and wondered, you know, what is the greatest evolutionary innovations of all time? Now, I don't know about you, but I really can't pick the greatest one. But I can tell you some that are very important. One of those is photosynthesis. Most of us know a little bit about photosynthesis. I mean, we know that plants take in carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, they absorb water from their roots, and they use the energy in sunlight to combine the carbon dioxide and water together to form a carbohydrate. And of course, photosynthesis requires the light reaction. That's where you take the energy in sunlight and you transform that into potential energy. And then there's the Calvin cycle, and that's where you actually take carbon dioxide and fix it into an organic molecule. And because plants are autotrophic, which means they are self-feeding, we know that we get most of our food from plants, and also the air that we breathe, the oxygen in the air, comes from photosynthesis. Oxygen, of course, is a byproduct of this process. But did you know that photosynthesis is really important for other reasons than just producing food? That photosynthesis has had a profound effect on life on this planet and on the planet itself. And to understand just how important photosynthesis for not just life living today by providing us food and oxygen, but for the entire evolutionary history of life on this planet. I know, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? To put this into perspective, the world today would be really different looking if it weren't for photosynthesis. And in fact, we may not even recognize our planet if we didn't have photosynthesis. Now, to understand just how much photosynthesis has altered the course of life on this planet, and the surface of the planet and the atmosphere as well, let's go back in time. And I mean, let's go way back in time. We're gonna hop in our imaginary car and go on a road trip, right? And one of my favorite ways of understanding deep time is 1 millimeter equals 1 year. Now, if we're gonna go back to the origins of life, which is almost 4 billion years ago, we would have to drive 4,000 kilometers. That is almost 2,400 miles going 1 millimeter equals 1 year. So in my life of 46 years, to go back to 1974, I would only have to drive 46 millimeters. The very first cells on this planet were little more metabolically active rocks. The first life on this planet relied on geological processes to supply them with energy. And if it weren't for photosynthesis, life would basically remain this way, eking out a living in some primordial soup and relying on ancient thermal vents. Also, the beginning of life, there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. And if there was, it was in tiny, tiny, tiny amounts. Because one thing you need to know about oxygen, it's highly electronegative. That means it likes electrons. And if you remember from your chemistry class, I know, chemistry. Not everybody likes it, but let's go back to our chemistry class. We make and break bonds by sharing electrons, and oxygen loves electrons, so oxygen is very good at making new bonds with other molecules. It oxidizes things, which isn't always good for life, but it can be. So if we go back 4 billion years ago, life on this planet was simple. Ecosystems on this planet were really simple. Because like I said, there just wasn't a lot of nutrients and energy available to life. Now, we don't know exactly when photosynthesis began. The very first attempts at photosynthesis used carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide to make carbohydrates. They did not produce oxygen. We don't know exactly when the first oxygenic photosynthesis evolved, but it was probably over 3 billion years ago. Now, oxygenic photosynthesis, like its name suggests, produces oxygen. So instead of using hydrogen sulfides, this form of photosynthesis used water. And that was a good thing, because as we all know, water is really abundant on this planet. So if you think about this, oxygenic photosynthesis, it uses some really abundant ingredients. It uses sunlight. We have plenty of that coming in. It uses carbon dioxide. And historically, way back billions of years ago, there was a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than today. And it, of course, used water. And most of our world is covered in water. So here we are, over 3 billion years ago, and we have oxygenic photosynthesis. These microbes, they are basically cyanobacteria, are fixing carbon dioxide and making carbon available to life. So we start to see life spreading across the planet because we have more resources available. Now, it wasn't like, we've got photosynthesis and we've got oxygen in the atmosphere. No, it actually took a long time for the next changes to occur. And in fact, over a billion years. Now, these cyanobacteria were pumping out oxygen. Now, as it pumped out oxygen into the atmosphere and into the water, that oxygen reacted with the iron in the water and it formed the banded iron formations. We actually mine those today for our iron and to smelt that iron into steel that we use for industry. So our oceans started out looking kind of like a dirty martini, right? They were kind of olive colored from all the iron in them, but the oxygen reacted with the iron, oxidized it, formed these rock formations called banded iron formations. Oxygen also got into the atmosphere, and this caused some pretty profound changes. Originally, our atmosphere had almost no oxygen in it. The first life evolved with basically no oxygen in the atmosphere. I know that's weird. We always think as an animal that we have to have oxygen or that life needs oxygen to survive. Well, not really. So what happened is, as oxygen got into the atmosphere has always had nitrogen in it and water vapor and some carbon dioxide. And 3 billion years ago, a lot more carbon dioxide, but it also had methane in it. And methane and oxygen like each other and they react and it forms carbon dioxide and water. So what happened is, as oxygen gets into the atmosphere, it reacts with the methane and basically oxidizes them, and our atmosphere goes from looking kind of hazy to this nice clear skies that we see today. And that was big. And that actually caused some of the first changes to our planet in terms of the climate. About 2 billion years ago, we start to see these changes. One of them is we have this great oxygen event. And I'm going to come back to that and how that affects life, but I want to talk about the climate first. You see, 2 billion years ago, the sun was not as bright as it is today. And in fact, it was probably about 80% as bright. And that presented a real paradox. If the sun was only 80% as bright as it is today, how come we weren't in an ice age? How come the Earth was not covered in ice billions of years ago? And the answer is the greenhouse effect. Methane, as you well know, is a great greenhouse gas. Well, as these cyanobacteria continually pumped out oxygen into the atmosphere, it reacted with all that methane. And when it reacted with the methane, the Earth began to cool, and we went into our first snowball Earth about 2.2 billion years ago. And this is a time period when the Earth was covered in snow and ice all the way down to the equator. It would look like ice planet Hoth or something like that. So there's an example of how photosynthesis greatly affected the climate. Now, of course, the Earth did not stay in that snowball. It actually came out of that after about 100 million years or so. Let's get back to how photosynthesis affected life on this planet. Now, as an animal, we breathe. We breathe oxygen. You cut us off from oxygen and we die. Oxygen definitely energized a life. But life evolved without oxygen. So early on, oxygen was pretty detrimental to life. I mean, oxygen likes to oxidize things. So it damages cellular membranes. It damages DNA. And it damages proteins. And in fact, even today, part of our aging process is accumulating oxidative stress. So life had to deal with all this oxygen. Because for the first time, there was a lot of oxygen around. Well, it evolved cellular respiration. Wow, think about that. cellular respiration evolved by some bacteria was a response to dealing with oxygen. And what it did was quite fortuitous. It made much more energy available to life. Instead of getting 5 or 6 ATPs for each glucose molecule, now you can get like 30. It's like having a car and going on a road trip. Oh, one car only gets 10 miles to the gallon, one gets 40. Where are you going to go further on? Yeah, the one that gets 40. Oxygen energized life. Now, eventually, this aerobically respiring bacteria got inside of another prokaryote called an archaean, and they formed a symbiotic relationship and went on to evolve into eukaryotic cells. And this was the first major restructuring of cells in 2 billion years of Earth's history. We have eukaryotic cells, these larger, more complex cells. And of course, we know the story from there. It is eukaryotic cells that went on to evolve true multicellular organisms like the plants, the animals, and the humans. And in fact, there are no truly multicellular bacteria or archaeans. The prokaryotes just can't really form multicellular life, but eukaryotes can. So as you can see, photosynthesis was really important because it changed the world, and it also changed the course of evolution for life on this planet. So when you look out today at our world, or we see it in a satellite image as our pale blue dot, we can thank photosynthesis for the high amount of oxygen in our atmosphere. We can thank photosynthesis for the evolution of cellular respiration that led to the evolution of plants and animals. So we are here today because photosynthesis. And there's one other thing that I want to talk about. Not only does photosynthesis release oxygen into the atmosphere, but that oxygen high up in the atmosphere forms an ozone layer. And ozone protects the planet from ultraviolet light. And in fact, without our ozone layer, we really would not have any life on the surface of the planet. I mean, you might have some microbes and some really hardy things that could survive the ultraviolet radiation, but we wouldn't have forests, we wouldn't have the world that we see today. And interestingly, ultraviolet light is strong enough to break water. It can split water in half. And when you do that, you form hydrogen gas and oxygen. Now, the Earth is not big enough to hold on to hydrogen, so it would escape into space after a few months. So the issue here is, if we didn't have our oxygen in the atmosphere, we wouldn't have an ozone layer. And eventually, we would lose our oceans. Ultraviolet light coming in from the sun would break the water, split it into oxygen, which would react with our rocks. The hydrogen gas would escape into space. And over billions of years, the Earth would dry up and eventually look like Mars, a dead, oxidized planet. So by now, I hope you see that photosynthesis is kind of important. Now I want to switch gears, and I want to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of photosynthesis. Now I started off earlier, and I said, photosynthesis has two parts to it. It's got a light reaction, and it's got the second part called the Calvin cycle. Now, light reaction, what it does is it takes the energy in sunlight and it transforms that energy into potential energy. It also splits water into oxygen and hydrogen. And it's the oxygen that we get from photosynthesis actually comes from the water molecules. Now, this is important because a light reaction is transforming the kinetic energy in sunlight to potential energy. And then we have the Calvin cycle. And the Calvin cycle is a series of chemical reactions that takes the energy from the light reaction and uses that to stick carbon dioxide onto an organic molecule. And that's what we call fixing carbon dioxide. Now, here's some interesting things about photosynthesis in terms of these two processes. Don't worry, I'm not going to try to cover every chemical reactions of the Calvin cycle here. I'd probably lose you pretty quick. But here's something that I do want you to think about. Photosynthesis evolved in a time period where there was no oxygen. And the mechanisms of photosynthesis, the Calvin cycle, has changed very, very little in 3 billion years. That's pretty wild because we have a lot more oxygen now and the world has changed. But the basics of photosynthesis have remained the same. including one very important protein enzyme that you may have never heard. That's called Rubisco. Now, don't confuse that with Crisco or Nabisco. Rubisco, ribulose bisphosphate oxidase carboxylase. Oh my gosh, how many people did I lose on that one, right? Okay, I know. At the risk of losing you over talking chemistry, I'm going to try it a little bit anyways. Remember, ribose, that's a 5-carbon sugar. Bisphosphate, I don't know why they don't just call it biphosphate. Bi means 2, phosphate means little phosphate group. Anytime you hear about phosphate getting added to an organic molecule, it increases its potential energy. And when you increase the potential energy of a molecule, it's easier to break. Think about this, carbon dioxide. Light a match around carbon dioxide or water, nothing happens. These molecules have no potential energy. Throw a match on gasoline and, well, I mean, don't do that. It'll explode because gasoline has a lot of potential energy. Ribulose bisphosphate is an organic molecule that's 5 carbons with lots of potential energy. We also call ribulose bisphosphate RUBP. So we'll just call it RUBP from now on. But Rubisco is a ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase. Now what that means is it's an enzyme, that's the ASE, ACE part of it. And that enzyme takes carbon dioxide and sticks it onto a 5-carbon sugar. So in this Calvin cycle, this enzyme, Rubisco, takes carbon dioxide and sticks it onto RUBP, a 5-carbon compound. Now I add carbon dioxide or carbon to a 5-carbon compound, I have a 6-carbon compound. But remember, I told you that RUBP has tons of potential energy. That makes it unstable. The minute that Rubisco sticks that carbon dioxide on there, it immediately splits into 2 3-carbon compounds. And we have a C3 pathway. And then from there, the Calvin cycle will continue a series of chemical reactions, making carbohydrates along the way. Now let's get back to this Rubisco. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase, Rubisco. It is also an oxidase. Rubisco evolved in a time period where there was no oxygen. So if there's too much oxygen inside the plant, it can also fix oxygen onto RUBP. And what happens there is you get an oxidation reaction, and this is called photorespiration. Now, photorespiration, this costs the plant some energy, and it also loses some of the carbon that it just fixed. Now, we think that photorespiration actually helps protect plants from intense sunlight. But the point is that this metabolic pathway is costing the plant energy and resources. So you can bet that plants have come up with ways to conserve resources. And we know this because we find plants living in very hot, dry environments. So let's shift gears. And what I want to talk about now are how plants have adapted to drier environments and conserve water. Plants need water, and they get water from their roots, right? And in fact, water from the roots will move passively all the way up to the leaves. I mean, this could be 300 feet high in the air, and water forms a continuous column inside the xylem. Okay, the main issue for plants and water stress is they don't want that continuous column of water broken, and here's why. Water has to continually move through a plant, and it does so passively. It's called the cohesion tension surface hypothesis for how it moves. But basically, on the underside of leaves are these small openings called the stomata, and surrounding the stomata are these guard cells. And these guard cells can open and close. So, times are good, plenty of water, got sunlight, the guard cells open up, and that allows gas exchange. So, carbon dioxide can enter the leaf, oxygen can exit the leaf, and so does water. And as water evaporates from the leaf, it's called evapotranspiration. It actually pulls water up from the roots, just like you sucking on a straw. The problem arises is when plants become water stressed. If they can't get enough water from their roots, they could break that column of water. It's called cavitation. And when that happens, that branch will die at the point of that cavitation where there's an air bubble in there. So plants have ways to conserve water. And one of the ways they do this is by closing their stomata. But that presents a problem to the plant, right? Because as you close your stomata, yeah, you can stop water flow, you can conserve water, but oxygen begins to build up inside the leaf and carbon dioxide levels get drawn down. And when this happens, Rubisco goes from carboxylating things to oxidizing things. The plant goes into photorespiration. So plants have evolved a couple ways around this. One of them is a C4 pathway. So earlier, I mentioned the C3 pathway. That is when Rubisco, one of the most important enzymes on the planet, takes carbon dioxide, fixes it onto an organic molecule, and it forms a 3-carbon compound, hence a C3 pathway. So the Calvin cycle is a C3 pathway. And in most plants, when you pick up a leaf, most of that leaf that you see is made up of something called a mesophyll cell. And that is where photosynthesis takes place. That's where all the chloroplasts are. So C4 pathways do something a little different. And the most obvious of that is when they fix carbon dioxide for the first time, they make a C4 compound, hence C4 pathway. But here's how they do that. Things are a little bit different in a C4 plant. If we talk about a C3 plant, most of the photosynthesis occurs in the mesophyll cells. There are these other cells called the bundle sheath cells. So if you ever pick up a leaf or a blade of grass, you will notice that it has veins in it. And those veins are the vascular tissue, you know, the xylem and the phloem. And surrounding that vascular tissue are the bundle sheath cells. And they help regulate the movement of materials in and out of the vascular tissue. And in a regular C3 plant, photosynthesis takes place in both the mesophyll cells and those bundle of sheath cells. Now in a C4 plant, things are a little different. Initial carbon fixation takes place in the mesophyll cells, but instead of using Rubisco, they use another protein enzyme, and this one is called PEP carboxylase. We saw that name again, carboxylase, and this one's called PEP, phosphoenolpyruvate. Oh, I know, more of that chemistry. But phospho, there's our phosphate group again. This is a energy-rich or a molecule with lots of potential energy attached to a pyruvate. Oh no, you've seen pyruvate before. Trust me, it was in cellular respiration. It's a 3-carbon compound. So if you've got PEP carboxylase adding carbon dioxide to phosphoenolpyruvate, a 3-carbon compound, 1 + 3, 4, and you have a 4-carbon compound. So in a C4 plant, we have the initial fixation of carbon taking place by another enzyme only in the mesophyll cells, and it forms this 4-carbon compound, I think oxalacetate. And then what happens is that 4-carbon compound is moved into those bundle sheath cells surrounding the vascular tissue. And that 4-carbon compound then releases a CO2 molecule into the mesophyll cell. And when it does so, that CO2 is then fixed by Rubisco into a C3 compound. So a C4 plant's doing both. They're still doing the carbon cycle here. And then, of course, once you remove that carbon from that 4-carbon compound, it's a 3-carbon compound, and it gets phosphorylated and sent back into the mesophyll cells. So think about what's happening here. A C4 plant is concentrating carbon dioxide into the bundle sheath cells. And it's doing that by separating where it originally fixes carbon dioxide in the mesophyll cells and where it does the Calvin cycle in the bundle sheath cells. Now, the advantage of PEP carboxylase is it has no affinity for oxygen. So in a C4 plant, as the plant becomes drought stressed, it can close the stomata. And then as oxygen levels begin to rise and CO2 levels go down, PEP carboxylase does not begin to fix oxygen. The plant does not go into photorespiration as quickly. And then it'll take and concentrate CO2 into bundle sheath cells so that Rubisco can fix it and go through the Calvin cycle. It's quite brilliant. Now, you might be wondering, why in the world doesn't all plants fix carbon dioxide using PEP carboxylase? I mean, you could avoid photorespiration this way. Well, there are always trade-offs to everything. The problem with PEP carboxylase and using phosphoenolpyruvate, there's your phosphate group again. It takes the plant energy to recharge pyruvate into PEP, into phosphoenolpyruvate. So this extra step takes more energy. Whereas if you have plenty of water, a C3 plant will typically outgrow a C4 plant giving them plenty of water because it doesn't require the extra step. It doesn't require that extra energy. So to sum up, how a C4 plant can conserve water is it separates the initial carbon fixation in the mesophyll cells and then concentrates carbon dioxide into bundle sheath cells. So it's separating out initial carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle in space. But the trade-off is, of course, it takes energy to do that. And plants that are C4 plants are typically a lot of our warm season grasses. Whereas most trees you're familiar with are C3 plants. Now, plants even have a more extreme way of conserving water. If you've ever seen a picture of a desert full of cactus, they do something called a CAM system. All right, let's see if I can say this. Crassulacean acid metabolism. I have a hard time pronouncing plant names sometimes, but Crassulacean comes from Crassulaceae. That's a family of plants, commonly known as the stone crops. These are succulents, and they're adapted to very dry environments. Now, here's how a CAM system works. It separates initial carbon fixation and time. You see, in the morning, it's cooler, and the relative humidity is much higher, so you don't lose as water as quickly. So these stone crops, cactus, bromeliads, think pineapple, they open up their stomata first thing in the morning, and they allow gas exchange. And they take the carbon dioxide, and they store it as an organic acid, typically a four-compound acid, I think oxalacetate again. And then, when it gets hot and dry, they'll close their stomata for the rest of the day, and they'll slowly release carbon dioxide so the plant can do photosynthesis. And of course, if you've ever owned a cactus, you know that they do not grow very fast. So the trade-off here is cactus and stone crops can live in really dry environments, much too dry for a C3 plant or a C4 plant. But the trade-off is they grow slowly. So interestingly, both of these pathways, CAM pathways, C4 pathways, they still rely on Rubisco and the Calvin cycle to make carbohydrates. And both of these pathways are really kind of young, evolutionarily speaking. I mean, Rubisco and the Calvin cycle have been around for 3 billion years. But we think that C4 pathways first evolved as recently as 35 or so million years ago and in grasses. And the reason why they evolved about 35 million years ago is because during the entire Cenozoic era, which started about 65 million years ago, the Earth has been slowly getting cooler and drier. And there's several reasons why the Earth has been getting cooler and drier over the last tens of millions of years. And a lot of that has to do with the positions of the continents affecting global circulation patterns, affecting how you move heat from the tropics to the poles, and also the position of mountain ranges. And those positions of the mountain ranges, when you start getting large mountains being built, they can remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through rock weathering. And as the Earth has gotten cooler and drier, we've seen these expansions of large grasslands. In fact, two of these large biomes, the savannas and the grasslands, well, of course, they're dominated by grasses, many of them C4 plants. And even today, most of our agriculture is grown in these grasslands, growing C4 plants, like corn, sugarcane, sorghum, and millet. And as you can see, these are very important plants for our agriculture. Well, I hope you like this podcast and you have a little bit deeper appreciation for the importance of photosynthesis, not just for life on the planet, but also for the planet itself and especially the climate. And to me, it's always been interesting to know that photosynthesis has largely remained intact for 3 billion years, changing very little. But yet, as the Earth has cooled off over the last 35 or so million years, the plants did evolve different ways of surviving in this cooler, drier environment. They came up with two different ways of fixing carbon dioxide, initially at least. One was a C4 pathway, and one is a CAM pathway. But despite that, they still rely on Rubisco and the Calvin cycle to make their carbohydrates. Until next time, this has been Tom SciCast, and I'm your host, Tom Kennedy.